Pat's like, the fuck? His face, he just turns around and is like...
When I'm singing alone in the apartment, he just meows at me.
That's what my cat does.
He gets really upset.
I think cats think that singing is like a distress call.
Yeah, like we're screaming for help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My cat's always like, meow, 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 meow. She's like, is everybody okay? Are we in danger?
Am I okay?
Oh, no.
Oh, no. We're going to have the weirdest cold open of our lives.
Are you a good witch or a bad bitch? Bad
bitch, bad bitch. I've been a rebel all my life.
We will not remain hidden figures. We have names.
Oh, if it's naughty to ruse your lips, shake your shoulders, shake your hips, and let a lady confess I want to be best.
I didn't kid you, did I? Well, now you know.
Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Deanna. Yes, this is morning time. We're trying the morning. We've got our Bloody Marys and Marias instead of wine.
Mm-hmm. We had coffee.
We had coffee.
And we are not on the verge of sleeping.
Yes. We're trying some new things.
Yep.
Yeah. I think it's going to be good. I feel energized.
I feel really great. As you could tell, I was very energized based off of my... my sirens,
mm-hmm.
and just intentionally trying to freak out the cat.
Yeah.
There's cat hair on the mic. I just got it.
Ew.
It's okay. I got it.
That was a really extreme reaction I just had. I don't know.
To your cat
To my
hair.
Cat. I'm covered in cat hair all the time. I, oh, sorry, cat.
Anyway. Any what's.
Heads up, witches.
What's up, witches? Welcome to yet another installment of Good Witches.
Bad Bitches.
With your hosts, Deanna and Hannah.
I like how it's like a little bit different every time, but
yeah,
it's good.
Yeah.
It works out well.
I'm into it.
Yeah.
I'm into it.
So who have we done so far? We've covered some bad bitches from 1920s. Mm-hmm.
1940s,
yeah. 1940s. Oh, cat.
There he goes. Off. There he goes. Angry kitty.
Oh, he's gonna be mean to me.
Yep. We've done Queenie so far, Hazel, Janice, and Lily.
Yep.
And we got more coming your way.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
It's been awesome because I have a few friends who listen to this mm-hmm. now so far, and every time we put up a new episode, I get like a string of text messages about people that we should do on this podcast, people who I have never heard of, and so I have a very nice long list now of suggestions because...
That's fabulous.
Yeah, I've been lucky.
One of these days we're going to pick the same person.
I
like that we have a little check-in system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we like to surprise each other with who it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess theoretically we could send them to Ben.
Yeah.
But then it's spoiled for him too.
Well, whatever. He can deal with it. It might get to a point where we have to do that.
Hi, kitty.
Once we've been doing this for a little while.
Yeah.
But before we launch into today's episode... So we're recording on Sunday, the Sunday after the March for Our Lives.
Woop woop.
So one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it is just because we already have touched on Parkland and we've touched on
yep.
what those students are doing and
how inspiring they are.
And how inspiring they are. And yep. we just watched Emma Gonzalez's speech.
Her new speech, yeah.
Her speech that she did yesterday in D.C. and it was six.
We had a good cry.
Yeah, had mm-hmm. a very good cry. I mean...
Over here in the witch den.
Yeah. Because it was a very powerful speech, and yep. half of it was completely silent. And that was clearly, like, terrifying to the crowd. Like, they didn't know what to do with themselves. They didn't know what to do at that time.
I mean, I liked that they started chanting Never Again. Mm-hmm. That was great.
Yeah.
And I think that it, like, bolstered her mm-hmm. and made her feel... encouraged. And
yeah. But it's we're living in a really fucking weird time. And
well, because you know our president isn't even paying attention to the hundreds of thousands of people around the world.
No, because where was he?
He was in Mar-a-Lago.
He was in fucking Mar-a-Lago.
Although I hear that there was a part of the march, some people organized to walk past Mar-a-Lago. Because everybody knew he went to go fucking golf because he does not give a shit.
No.
About Americans.
No.
He gives a shit about Donald Trump. That's it.
Yep. No, he loves using our fucking money to go and play golf every other weekend.
I'm so glad I pay his paycheck.
Yeah. It's really nice to know that, like, money that I'm paying is going to flying his people around in private jets and paying for their vacations and paying mm-hmm. for him to golf.
I'm paying to protect Trump Tower.
Yeah. It's really heartening to know that we're using our money so well. It's really great.
Yeah, but please, let's cut funding to the arts and education.
Well, yes. And it's the arts and education that have helped make these students at Stoneman Douglas so articulate too.
Right.
Which, like, people keep saying, and I completely understand this, that, like, well, they're able to do this because they came from a school that had resources, and these students come from a school that had,
oh, you know, of course.
And yes, obviously that's part of it, but, like, that should be an argument for why we need to keep those programs. It should be an argument for why those things need to exist.
Right.
Like, I don't know why people use that as this, oh, well, they have a good education, so fuck them. Like, what they say doesn't matter because they're trained well. It's bizarre. It's so weird.
That logic.
But I'm just really excited that Emma and her compatriots are leading the charge on this, because teens are kind of leading the charge on a lot of things right now.
Go teens, go.
Go teens, go. Dude, were you the one who just showed me the protest sign that someone made?
Yeah.
Of her at the protest yesterday at the march, and they had her picture, and what did it say? The sign?
Actually, I think it was Ben.
That was within every generation a slayer is born.
Oh no, that was me. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it said, there was an asterisk, and it said, I know you don't get this reference, but trust me, it's a compliment. Thank you for everything that you do. My favorite one that I saw that's circulating the interwebs right now is a kid who has a sign that says, "When I said I'd rather die than go to math class, that was hyperbole, asshole."
Oh, God. So I watched this segment on, like, a John Oliver segment on NRA TV, and
Isn't it horrifying?
It's batshit.
Yeah.
It's absolutely batshit.
Yeah.
And I really,
it's advertising. That's all it is.
Well, that's all it is. It's, yes.
The gun companies.
But it makes me crazy to
normalize gun culture.
Like, money speaks so much louder than people realize. And greed speaks so much louder than people realize, and it dictates so much more of our legislation than people realize.
Yeah.
And this especially has brought a lot of that to light for me, because of all of the fucking segments on the NRA and, you know, Parkland shooting and blah, blah, blah. All of that stuff brings it all out into the light how fucked up that all is.
Yeah. And the bit where they slut-shamed marijuana.
Oh!
Did you see that? Where NRA TV had an ad that was basically slut-shamed.
Sexy Mary Jane or something.
Yeah, it was
shit.
Like, she's a harlot and she hides in the shadows. And she, I was like, what?
What the
Her
fuck?
Name is Mary Jane. It's like, all right, NRA TV, we need to cool it. Because literally everyone on, like, marijuana is not political in so far as who uses it, because I know so many, like, rednecks, like, I hesitate to say they're my family because there's a few of them, but it's just, like, people who consider themselves to, they're Trump-supporting, gun-toting, like, redneck white people, and they smoke weed. Like, everybody smokes weed. Come on. Like, why are you demonizing marijuana that way? They just have more shame about it.
Oh, that's
like liberals
so true.
Smoke weed, conservatives smoke weed. Come on, frat boys smoke weed all the time.
They have more shame about it. That's a good explanation for so many things.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Oh, man. I sent Ben like a Tumblr post that led to an article the other day, but it was basically just about the friend zone and where that comes from. And it was really interesting because I had never thought about this before, and maybe you've seen this or heard of this, but it was about the psychology of, like, female friendships versus male friendships. And
oh, yeah, I sent this to you.
Did you send this to me? So I sent it on to him.
I think. I've sent it to, like, everybody. It's great.
It's one of those things. But it's basically like about how men can't, or they're not encouraged to have meaningful relationships with one another, and women are encouraged to have meaningful relationships with one another.
Yeah, because women, the way women interpret friendship is very emotionally supportive and mm-hmm. very caring, basically. I mean, that's a big blanket statement, but,
yeah.
you know, we're socialized and have, you know. We're very supportive. You and I specifically are very touchy-feely and lovey, mm-hmm. even though we've never had a sexual relationship of any kind.
Right.
Yet.
That's for a different podcast, Deanna.
Oh, no. Yeah, but no, seriously, though, it's like when men have a female friend, and because women are like, yeah, we're friends. I support you emotionally. I lift you up. I listen to you. I care about you. I do this. But men don't have as frequently, again, blanket statements, those types of friendships. That's not how male friendship works.
Yeah.
And so when women...
Because men aren't supposed to be vulnerable.
Right. And so when women give that, they're like, oh, romantic. This is, you're leading me on. And when women are like, wait, no, we're just friends.
Yeah.
And men are like, well, fuck you, bitch. It's like...
Yeah.
And this is, that's where the disconnect is, mm-hmm. is because that's,
I know
that for women, it's like, no, but this is how friendship is. And they're like, no, this is romantic relationship stuff.
Right. Because I only am vulnerable with the women who I'm in a relationship with.
Or their mothers.
And that's a different issue.
Yeah.
But it's so simple, but it was really enlightening for me.
It's powerful. Yeah.
Because it explains so much. I mean, it even explains, like, that fucking... well, it doesn't explain this, but, you know, it helps to explain a lot of these fucking entitled white dudes who...
Yeah, and that's why...
Do awful crimes.
Why they get confused about it. I mean, not to give any sort of excuse in any way, but, like, it's understandable why, psychologically, that would be confusing...
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you should be angry at women about it.
Well, yeah, your reaction to it is your own fucking problem, sir. But, yeah, like that whole friend zone thing, because it's so prevalent and it confounds me. But now I'm like, oh, well, okay. It's fucking toxic masculinity.
Ruins the party
keeping
again.
Men from being able to have friendships with one another and keeping them from understanding, like, that women just... They expect emotional support from their friends, regardless of sexual, you know, relationship.
And I read this article recently about how modern days, that was a really weird way to say it.
But
in modern time, like, toxic masculinity has gotten to such a place that it has robbed men of touch. Because they showed these examples of throughout history, like when photographs were first being taken or whatever, of just male friendships, and they were touchy-feely, they were hugging, they were like, they had their hand on each other's mm-hmm. thighs, and it wasn't, I mean, I'm sure maybe some of them were like homosexual, sure, but the point is that that's what male friendship used to have.
Yeah.
Like, you men used to be able to touch each other and not be like, gay. Like, there's none of that. But today, men can't.
Yeah.
And so they're so weird about being touched and hugged and appreciated in a non-sexual way. It's, like, so sad. It makes me so sad. As a person who, one of my biggest love languages is touch. Like, I crave it all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are men who are the same, but they can't.
But they can't do it. I know.
Like, why can't male friends cuddle? Like, that's so cute.
I know.
We do.
We do. Like, we took a nap next to each other on my bed last weekend.
We did.
Yeah.
It was really sweet.
We cuddled a little bit.
We did.
It was really cute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We held, we like, locked pinkies for part of it. Like, I just.
It was.
And we fell asleep with our pinkies locked. Because we're weird. Gosh.
Yeah, that was
because we
weird.
Cute.
Yeah, we're so cute. Oh my god. On that note,
do you want to hear about a woman that's really awesome?
Uh huh.
Who was fantastic? Who? I mean, I'm just blown away by her, actually. So I'm really excited to tell you about her.
Yay!
She's possibly one of my favorite insofar as what she accomplished and her bravery and courage and all this stuff. So today I'm going to talk about Dr. Gisela Pearl. Do you know Dr. Gisela Pearl?
Never heard that name.
All right. So it's maybe not going to be the funniest of episodes, but she's a really important person to learn about. I would like to thank a few websites that gave me all my information. AllThat'sInteresting.com, History.com, and the New York Times is where I got the majority of this information.
Great.
So let's talk about Gisela Pearl, who she was born in Hungary in 1907. And she was really smart from a very young age. At the age of 16, she was the only woman and the only Jewish person to graduate from her secondary school. She graduated first in her class.
Damn.
So not only, like, the only woman, the only Jew, and she graduated first in her class.
God.
After she graduated, she asked her dad if she could go to medical school. She really wanted to be a doctor. Her dad was initially hesitant to support those aspirations, particularly in medicine, because he thought that somehow it would lead her to abandon her Jewish faith.
Oh.
I'm not sure why. I guess maybe it's about, like, some version of science taking you away from religion. I don't know.
If anyone has any ideas on that, let us know.
Yeah. I'm not sure why that would be incompatible. But regardless, she assured him that her aspirations to be a doctor would not take her away from being a faithful Jew. She didn't relent. She kept asking him. She returned to her father months later, this time holding a prayer book that he had given her. And she said, "I swear on this book that wherever life will take me, under whatever circumstance, I shall always remain a good, true Jew." So then her dad gave in. Years later, when she was paid by her first patient, she bought him a prayer book with his name engraved in it.
Aww.
Yeah. So she proved that. In 1944, Dr. Pearl was working as a gynecologist. She had just married a surgeon and was living in a Jewish ghetto with her family in Hungary, which is now Romania. It was Hungary at the time.
Okay.
And, of course, 1944 was the year that the Germans invaded. In March of that year, Dr. Pearl and her husband, son, parents, and extended family were sent to Auschwitz, where they were all separated from each other.
Oh,
her young daughter, however, was hidden with a non-Jewish family, so she didn't go to Auschwitz.
Oh.
I'm going to butcher this name because I don't speak German, but I didn't look it up, I should have, but Dr. Josef Mengele, he's a German physician and was the SS captain of Auschwitz. Found out she was a doctor, immediately assigned her work in the hospital.
Oh.
Yeah. Because he didn't want to do shit except for the gross, horrifying experiments that he was known for.
Great.
So Dr. Pearl recalled that her first duties, were pretty standard. She would bandage bloody heads, treat broken ribs, cleaning wounds, because constantly the people in Auschwitz were being beaten, and
tortured. I'm surprised that they even bothered to treat those people.
Yeah, but she didn't have any tools. She had no antiseptic. She had no tools. She had no nothing.
So it was a
hospital. Was just like, you're a doctor. Whatever. Take care of them.
Oh, God.
Yeah. She was encouraged to tell inmates that they should donate their blood to be used for the German army. Yeah, great.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Are you fucking kidding me?
they encouraged the fucking prisoners of Auschwitz to donate blood for the war effort.
Are you serious?
Isn't that horrifying?
So there were German soldiers and German troops who had blood transfusions from Jewish prisoners?
So it would seem. Yeah.
That's fucked up.
I know.
Oh my God, that makes me so angry.
This whole thing is
God.
The Holocaust itself, of course. Soon, however, her tasks became more arduous when Dr. Mengele realized that she was a gynecologist. He saw an opportunity to obtain information about which inmates had arrived pregnant. She was ordered to inform him. He was also known as the Angel of Death, by the way, of any pregnant women within the camp. Pregnant women, he told her, would be sent to a different camp, one with better care for mother and child. She didn't buy that at all. She had already seen the horrors that prisoners faced at the hands of the Nazis and the doctor in particular, so she knew better than to believe him. She also knew that she wouldn't tell him, and she immediately knew she wouldn't tell him about a single pregnancy, but she didn't know how she would keep it a secret. She had to figure that out. Yeah. So some women arrived to the camps pregnant. Others became pregnant in the camp, where sexual exchanges and rape were all too common. Within the camps, women's bodies and sexuality were objects that both SS officers and sometimes male prisoners felt they had the right to possess and use. In fact, I did not know this. This is horrifying to me. There was a special barracks that the SS used to rape and molest women, despite decrees against engaging in sexual acts with Jewish women. Their actions and feelings toward Jewish women created inner conflicts for the officers, leading to violence against the women who were blamed for seducing them.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Absolutely. One survivor of Auschwitz said, quote, "I was with my mother and we saw these women in striped uniforms with blonde hair, some longer than others. I remember asking my mother why they were allowed to have long hair while we weren't. And my mother said to me, that's because that's how the SS like them. And I didn't know what it meant at the time."
Whoa.
End quote.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
That's like the skeeviest, most horrifying thing. While most sexual acts in Auschwitz were not consensual, sometimes sex was used as a commodity in exchange for goods. It says, upon her arrival, Dr. Pearl was given men's shoes that were far too big for her, and she needed string to tighten them. So she learned of a male prisoner who had some string. When she was able to locate him, she brought her bread ration as an exchange for the string. He wasn't interested in the food. He looked her up and down, and he demanded her body.
No.
She was disgusted, but she knew that in order to survive, in order to do her work, she needed shoes to be able to work as a doctor. And so it was kind of a matter of life and death, so she acquiesced. Women used what they had to survive, I guess, in these camps, and their brave acts of trading sex for goods caused shame and embarrassment and could also lead to life-threatening pregnancy.
Yes.
Yep.
Wow.
So back to that conversation where Dr. Mengele said, you need to tell me about pregnant women because they'll be sent to better camps with more nutrition. She didn't buy that shit, but unfortunately there were some pregnant women who overheard this conversation and they like ran to him to tell them that they were pregnant of their own volition. So this angel of death doctor, bullshit asshole, in addition to experiments on the disabled, he was known for, also on twins. He did a lot of experiments on twins.
What does that mean, experiments on twins?
They just thought that it was a genetic, they could try different things to see how they, I don't know.
And remind me the point of these experiments. It was like,
I don't know.
Trying to...
It was learning about the human form, learning about what twins had in common, what made them different, things like that. I don't know.
And like
I don't
Nazis
know.
Nazis believed Aryan race was.
I
like,
don't know how to rationalize Nazi behavior. So.
No, I don't even. And that's not even. I
can't
what I
even.
Mean.
No, I know, but I can't even imagine.
I feel like I remember seeing a documentary, but I don't remember. I don't remember, and I want to now. But that was about that. About like these experiments that Nazis did on Jewish prisoners because they were seen as less than human, but
right.
You know, they were trying to do something.
They were trying to do it for the,
but who knows what that was.
Bettering of the human race in general. Their version of the superior race, but they were like, well, they recognized that Jews were enough like them that medical treatments would be the same, but thought that they were lesser enough to subject them to torture.
So fucked.
Great.
Because that's what it was. It was torture.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But he also performed horrific experiments on pregnant women, including vivisection, which is cutting up a body. Experimentation, in some cases, autopsy-like surgeries performed on living, waking humans. Yeah.
Oh, God.
And so tragically, the women who self-identified themselves as pregnant, they were all taken to the research block, were all taken to the research block to be used as guinea pigs. And then two lives would be thrown into the crematorium.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Mother and child, yeah. So she decided in that conversation right then and there, she would never reveal a woman's pregnancy, but even more that there should never be another pregnant woman in Auschwitz. She faced an enormous ethical crisis. So if she delivered babies so near to where Nazi physicians were, they would no doubt hear the infant's cries, know that she didn't inform, and would likely kill everyone in the barracks as a punishment.
Oh.
If she turned the pregnant women in, they would die anyway after suffering horrible torture at the hands of Mengele and his doctors. So she had no medicine, no medical instruments. She found herself wholly unprepared for the morally demanding work that she had decided she needed to undertake. So even though it went against her teaching and the social code of the day, she began performing rudimentary abortions in the barracks. She had no tools, nothing to disinfect her hands, and no pain relief of any kind.
Oh, God.
There were a couple articles that kind of went into a little bit of detail of how some of these went down. It's not necessary to know how she did it.
While I'm drinking a Bloody Maria.
Also, it's horrifying to think that she had to do without any, and the women who had to go through it without any.
That was preferable to any of the other options.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
So when she learned that a prisoner was pregnant, she would explain to the expectant mothers the situation. If the SS knew she was pregnant, her life and the life of her unborn child would be over.
Yeah.
She would perform abortions and terminate pregnancies in the middle of the night with her bare hands.
Oh.
On the dirty floors and bunks of the barracks. Mm. Occasionally, a woman would make it to the final stages of her pregnancy unnoticed by the SS somehow, and sometimes without even knowing it herself, like the woman wouldn't even know.
Because they were so starved.
And, and so she would perform the births, and when requested, would silently take the breath away from the newborns in order to save the mom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She envisioned a world where these women would have children with their loved ones after the war, raising a family outside the horrors of a concentration camp. Toward the end of the war, there were rare cases of babies being born within the camps of surviving. And also, it's because the Germans were then preoccupied by the encroaching Allied forces. Hundreds of times I had premature deliveries, she told the New York Times. No one will ever know what it meant to me to destroy these babies. But if I hadn't done it, both mother and child would have been cruelly murdered. She tells the story in her autobiography about one young woman who she delivered a baby for, and she had to destroy the baby, and then the mother was not doing well because it wasn't a great delivery, so she sent her to the hospital, the infirmary, with pneumonia, which was a chosen guise because pneumonia wasn't punishable by death.
Yeah.
If you had, like, typhoid, for example, the Nazis would just kill you.
God.
She had tried to keep the baby alive, but she was afraid that the cries would alert the guards. So it's a horrible quote, but I mean, it's her. She said, "I could hide him no longer," she wrote. "I took the warm little body in my hands, kissed the smooth face, and then strangled him and buried his body under a mountain of corpses waiting to be cremated."
Oh.
She thought she was doing the best she could in the face of unimaginably awful circumstances. She soon rationalized that in Auschwitz and other concentration camps, the role of the Jewish doctor was not to heal, but to hasten death.
Whoa.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, God. Just imagine realizing that,
but
like,
that's your best. Task.
Yeah, that's the best that you can offer to these people. As a prisoner yourself, that's, oh, God.
And that's so fucked. Like, you think about the fact that she was also a prisoner and
she had no power in this situation.
Right. Aside from the surgeries performed on pregnant women, she also tended to the wounds that the SS inflicted upon women's breasts with beatings and whips. She also treated women in the night for other conditions. She said that she felt helpless without tools and medicine. She recounted in her autobiography that she would, quote, "treat patients with my voice, telling them beautiful stories, telling them that one day we would have birthdays again, one day we would sing again. I didn't know when it was Rosh Hashanah, but I had a sense of when the weather turned cool, so I made a party with the bread, margarine, and dirty pieces of sausage we received for meals. I said, tonight will be the new year, tomorrow a better year will come." Like, so, yeah.
I'm gonna cry.
I know. As the Russian troops were approaching in 1945, the Germans began to hastily shut down gas chambers and concentration camps.
Because they knew it was fucking evil.
Well, they couldn't.
God!
Yeah. So she was moved to a camp near Hamburg 2 months later to Bergen-Belsen.
Bergen-Belsen.
It says Burleson when I copied and pasted. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I just know that because that's one that my papu.
Oh, okay.
Was around.
Yeah. So when the war was over and her camp was liberated, she spent months looking for her family. She remained in the camp until fall when she wandered throughout Germany by foot searching for her loved ones. After 19 days of doing this, she learned that while she was able to save countless lives in Auschwitz, she was the sole survivor of her family who went to the camps.
Oh.
Her father and her teenage son died in gas chambers, and her husband was beaten to death tragically just before the camp was liberated.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah. It's that's so sad. Like, ugh. The guilt, pain, and burden of the Holocaust, of course, weighed heavily on Dr. Pearl, leading to a suicide attempt in 1947. Mm. She tried to poison herself, but she survived and was taken to a convent in France to recuperate. After recuperating, Pearl went to New York City in 1947, where she was interrogated on suspicion of assisting Nazi doctors.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but there was lots of testimony of inmates of the camps that saved her life. One survivor said, "Without Dr. Pearl's medical knowledge and willingness to risk her life by helping us, it would be impossible to know what would have happened to me and many other female prisoners. And at that time, Eleanor Roosevelt invited her to lunch. And initially, Dr. Pearl declined her offer because she said, I'm kosher, so I can't come to your lunch. Gosh. But Eleanor Roosevelt insisted and provided her a kosher lunch.
Thank you,
of
Eleanor.
Of course, like, that's not that hard.
Yeah, that's not.
Dr. Pearl said in an interview with the New York Times that it was Eleanor Roosevelt who encouraged her to start practicing medicine again. Like, up until this point, she had not. She was like, nope, no way, can't do it anymore.
I can't imagine, I honestly don't, I can't imagine how you would after all of that.
Right, but Eleanor Roosevelt said, quote, stop torturing yourself, become a doctor again. And at that time, she was specially granted U.S. citizenship in 1951. She moved to New York City, and she began her career working at Mount Sinai Hospital, specializing in infertility.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's near here.
Yeah, really close to here.
All right.
She eventually opened up her own practice on Park Avenue, making it the sole mission of her life to bring life into the world. Quote, I was the poorest doctor on Park Avenue, but I had the greatest practice. All of Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen were my patients.
Wow.
Yeah. She was in practice in New York for 43 years. She delivered approximately 3,000 healthy babies.
Oh, wow.
3,000 healthy babies.
Oh, my God.
She said that every time she entered the delivery room, she would pray and she would say, God, you owe me a life, a living baby. Which that, like, breaks my heart. That's the most beautiful.
Oh.
She was like, you owe me this because of what I did. In 1948, she published her autobiography, which is called I Was a Doctor in Auschwitz. And she also discovered at some point that the daughter that she had hidden before the war had survived.
Oh.
So her daughter lived. She did, because she didn't go to the camps. Her daughter lived.
Oh, thank God.
So in 1979, she moved to Israel to be with her daughter and her grandson.
Wow.
In moving, she also fulfilled a vow that she made in 1944 to her husband and her father. So when they were separated in Auschwitz, like the last thing her father and her husband said to her were, we'll someday meet in Jerusalem.
Oh.
Yeah. So she moved to Israel for that purpose. And she lived in Israel with her family until her death on December 16th, 1988.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Gosh, that's the year I was born.
Yeah, me too.
Wow.
Yeah, on the 16th, too. You and I both have 16th birthdays.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. Today, Dr. Pearl is often referred to as the Angel of Auschwitz for both her work with expectant mothers and other hospital patients.
Damn.
She is the goodest of witches.
Yes. And
the fact she was able to save so many lives without any tools, without any. She was incredible. She was incredible.
Well, and it's so hard because, like, there are no good choices in that situation. Like, somebody's life, unfortunately, is at risk in that situation. And you don't, this is the thing, is like, especially right now while we're debating abortion again in this country, like, so deeply. And there are a couple, I think, I don't remember who it was who just passed, but like, no abortion in cases of, even in cases of rape and incest.
It's it was like Ohio or something.
Yeah, they're talking about, I'll look it up and.
Oh, rape, incest, and danger to the mother's life.
And danger to the mother's life.
Which is insane. It's insane to me.
It really boggles the mind because, you know, I don't know. There are situations where you really do have to ask yourself, what is important in life? Like, am I really going to fucking fight to force this person to give birth to this child? And that's that. And I'm not going to follow it from that point on. Like, then you look at situations like this where it's like, you know what? Women lived because of this person.
Yeah. She saved so many women's lives.
And it hurt her to do the things that she had to do. And that's,
of course,
awful. It's awful. But people lived because of her. So thank you.
She saved their lives. And again, like, it just blows my mind that she was able to do, not just even in the cases of abortions, but she did medical, surgical procedures on people and helped them without any tools. Like a true healer. She's a true, God.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after that, she delivered over 3,000 healthy babies because she was clearly an excellent, excellent gynecologist and doctor.
Yeah.
Exceptionally great.
That's a really amazing story.
Yeah.
I don't even know what else to say about it other than it's just fucking incredible.
She's a superhero, truly.
It simultaneously makes me, it makes me angry and it makes me happy and it makes me sad. Like, it just makes me all of these things all at once because the situations were so horrific.
And the fact that she lived through it and this horrifying doctor that she worked under who was an evil, evil man.
I mean,
never knew. She did all of this under his nose and in defiance of him and his orders and she was smart enough to be able to keep it.
Yeah.
It's like the ultimate act of rebellion.
I mean, how long did she have to do that for?
God, I don't even know. I mean,
at least a year.
Yeah. I mean, she was imprisoned in 1944. And then the camps were liberated in, 47? Is that what it said?
No. The camps were liberated in 45?
Oh, 47 is when she attempted suicide. 45. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, a year.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, so my papu passed away when I was a senior in high school.
Right.
So it's been a long time now, but he was in the war. He was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm.
And my mom tells me the story, and I'm sorry, Mom, if I butcher this story, but sometimes she and I will talk about this stuff because he finally opened up to her and her sisters years after the fact. I mean, they were,
That's rare.
I think it was a year or two before he passed that he finally was like, okay, this is what I endured in the war and this is what I saw. And they went to, Germany and Belgium and they went to Bergen-Belsen and they checked everything out. And she tells a story about, I don't know if my papu was part of this or if this was just something that was kind of adjacent to what he experienced, but when the camps were liberated and the people in the towns nearby were forced to bury the bodies of the people who were left dead in the camps because the people, and this is the American soldiers came in and they forced these villagers to bury these bodies because they were like, this was happening under your nose all along. And you said nothing. You did nothing. You said nothing. You smelled the burning bodies. You knew this was happening and you didn't do anything. Your silence was complicit. And so they forced them to dig mass graves and bury the rest of those bodies. And that's partially
heavy.
It's so heavy, it's so sad, and it took far too long for that to happen.
Yeah.
For that liberation to occur. Sorry to make this super heavy, but
No, I mean this whole episode is kind of particularly
heavy.
But she's a woman that needs to be talked about. People need to know her. She's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can't have
she made hard
every
choices.
Episode can't be
No, yeah, every
fun.
Yeah. Yeah, they can't all be Stephanie St. Clair or fucking Hazel Scott.
You're right.
Sometimes people do amazing things by making fucking difficult choices.
In really bleak times. Mm-hmm.
And that's
that even is putting it mildly.
Yes.
The Holocaust was bleak.
Oh, yes.
What's an understatement of the century?
Okay. Yeah, no, she sounds incredible.
I know. I'll show you. There's a beautiful picture of her. I think it was in the 80s or the 70s. It's just she's an old woman and she's just holding a little baby and the look of joy on her face. Just I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
I'm nothing compared to this woman. I'm a tiny speck of insignificant, unimportant, what am I doing with my, what am I doing to help my fellow humans? I don't know. Shit.
We'll figure it out.
Making a podcast, talking about Gisella Pearl. That's what I'm doing.
Girl.
Making sure people know her name.
Well done. Seriously. That was a really good story.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Do you want to lighten it up a little bit and talk about something that's made you happy this week? Maybe we'll end on a high note.
Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about something that made my day yesterday that sort of relates to, well, I've been really invested in like space and researching space. And part of that was a little bit inspired by Janice Voss.
Of course.
Because, like, obviously I came across her and I was like, oh, shit. And then now
I have to. Taking back to episode 3.
Yeah. Now I have to look into all of this stuff. And so Ben introduced me to a podcast called Planetary Radio, which I've been listening to. And so one of their recent episodes, it's like, I think it aired in January. I'm not entirely sure, but they went to a few different space related like conferences and interviewed people at these conferences, and
my mom might have been at one of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because she works for planetary scientists.
Oh.
Yeah. Did you not know that?
No. Yeah. I knew about her photography.
Well, yeah, she does that too.
But I didn't know about the other part.
My mom's a boss. We can talk about my mom on the show.
All right, let's talk about
your mom. She's like busy all the time, like working amazing. All her jobs, like taking care of shit.
Well, I want to hear about the other stuff besides all the other stuff besides the photography.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she works for the Southwest Research Institute. They're planetary scientists. She was at Encounter, which was, she was in Baltimore for like 6 weeks. I don't know how long. I'm sorry, Mom, you can correct me. I'm both telling mom stories where our moms, I'm sure, will.
I know. And they're going to be like, what are you doing?
But it was cool because I got to go visit her down in Baltimore. But she was there for a while.
Damn.
Yeah. Her boss, he's one of Time Magazine's like top 100 most influential people. He's cool.
Go mom.
I know. And so she was part of the team. She's not. I have a wonderful sign by all the female planetary scientists who were on the Encounter, which is the flyby of Pluto that happened a couple years ago.
Okay.
Where we now know all this information about Pluto, which, by the way, I will just say planetary scientists are really pissed off that astronomers have decided, people who study stars, mm-hmm. not planets, have decided that Pluto is no longer a planet because all planetary scientists still believe that Pluto is a planet. His name's Alan Stern. He has been advocating to try and debate Neil deGrasse Tyson on this front because Neil deGrasse Tyson is anti-Pluto being a planet and he is pro-Pluto being a planet. And he hasn't
Whoa.
Agreed to debate him yet. It's the craziest. Yeah. But it's really cool. So
Holy
she works
shit.
For, yeah.
That's amazing.
So my mom was probably at one of those
conferences
that you were talking about.
I'll link to that episode.
Yeah.
Or at least talk about which episode it was so that we can investigate.
Yeah.
But one of the teams that they talked to on this episode was a team of undergraduate students at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, who are building their own rocket.
Oh.
And they want to be the first college team to send a rocket like fully into space. And it's never been done before. I stress this, they are undergraduates. They're propulsion manager.
So they're all like 19, 20
They're
years
all
old.
Like 19, 20s. Yeah. This girl, the girl who is their propulsion manager, is a freshman at Berkeley.
Jesus.
She taught herself rocket science in 2 weeks.
Wait, what?
She taught herself rocket science in 2 weeks so that she could come on board as their propulsion manager and manage their team of propulsion scientists who are all undergraduates.
I couldn't learn rocket science in the full almost 30 years that I've been alive. This fucking girl.
Yeah.
She's like, 2 weeks. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, so. I wanted to do this interview. So, and they're a full-on business at this point. These young boys who started this are like, they have a team of 90 people.
Well,
and
I'm glad
that
a young lady has decided to join them.
But yeah, she is their propulsion person, and she's doing the thing to make this rocket work. And so it's obviously like people have sent rockets into space. That's not the thing that's revolutionary. The thing that is revolutionary is that it's these teenagers who are doing it themselves with like no fucking oversight.
Generation Z, man.
Generation Z, they are changing shit even as we speak.
That's so great.
I feel so bad for all of you people who don't think that they are doing amazing things because they are, and they're doing it with pleasure. And yeah.
They're going to lap the fuck out of all of us depressed millennials who were like, we were told we could have the world and
we left.
And now we're all in debt. And realize that when it's like you can do anything because baby boomers used to have unions and baby boomers have it great and then think we're entitled.
Yeah.
But and Gen Z, they came into this sardonic, cynical, like they saw us and they were like, oh, life is hard.
Guess we got to do shit for ourselves. Cool. Yeah. So we're going to start doing
they're
that.
They're the generation of hope. Like, yeah. I'll be hopeful about millennials. We're all pretty great, I will say.
We're starting to get to this point.
We're like depressed alcoholics who are all in debt up to our ears and just trying to make art, but in a world where art's not valued because baby boomers don't value it as much.
Yeah.
Except for the good ones. I know every time I talk shit about baby boomers, my mom's like, I'm a boomer. I'm like, okay,
whatever.
Mom.
We get it. Not all boomers.
All boomers. Mom, I know you're an artist. You're a good one. You're one of the good ones.
Yeah.
You're not the woman with the funky ass haircut. I'd like to speak to your manager, please. Like, fuck you. Sorry. I was a waiter for way too long in New York City and had to serve way too many entitled baby boomers.
Oh, trust me. I understand. I used to work at a bookstore in fucking mid-Manhattan.
Customer service.
Oh, yeah.
They say, you know, Israel does that where everybody has compulsory military service. Mm-hmm. I think people should have compulsory customer service. We would all be so much nicer.
Seriously.
We would all be so much... Like, that's the thing is that most millennials have worked in customer service, and not all, but most, and that's why most broke-ass millennials still tip 20% minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for me personally, because I've waited tables for many years, and I've worked in retail, and I've done all this shit, like... You have to do a lot to piss me off to get 15%. And that's 15%.
Yep.
That's still, like, the bare minimum. Otherwise, you get 20. I will tip the fuck out of you. I'm sorry. I've gone off the rails a little bit.
I'm like, just staring at you.
I'm very passionate about tipping culture because those people, if you are doing something that gets a tip, that warrants a tip, those people don't make shit.
No, they make like fucking $3 an hour.
Because they're not unionized. Their corporations that they work for are not supportive of paying them because their bottom line is money. And so they're reliant on your tip.
So in conclusion, tip
your waiters.
Tip your waiters.
Even if it's mediocre, tip them something.
Tip them something.
Tip people real well if they're great.
Pay attention to the students at UC Berkeley when they launch their rocket in July.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that.
I went out of control. It's fine. These students are amazing.
Yeah,
they're doing amazing things.
You're right. Gen Z is the bomb.
They're doing,
we were talking about how great Gen Z was, and then I went on a rant about baby boomers.
You're a fucking millennial. You ruin everything, don't you know?
Millennials are the murderers of industry.
Yeah, we fuck everything up. So thank you, Gen Z,
My favorite one was that we murdered the napkin industry because we all use paper towels. Because they're more durable. I don't know.
Oh my God, I don't use napkins.
Why would I buy napkins and paper towels? Who cares?
Who fucking cares?
Jesus. Anyway, yes, thank you, Gen Z.
Thank you, Gen Z.
Really excited.
I'm excited to see this rocket launch.
Fuck yeah.
They're doing it in, I think, New Mexico in July. So I'm going to figure out, so it's called their project is called Project Carman, K-A-R-M-A-N.
Carman.
I don't really know what that is, but their rocket is called Eureka.
Wait, again?
Yes, but with a K, as it was originally
intended. Yep.
And it's for the same reason, the fucking Archimedes.
Dorky scientists.
Yep. So the rocket Eureka with Project Carman is set to launch in July. So let's see if these undergraduate college students manage to make it work. But their website is legit.
Where are they getting their funding from?
They crowdfunded. All their money. I think they got like $30,000 so far.
That's insane.
Which is amazing. And they've been going to like conferences and they've been speaking about their project.
That's great.
So yeah, they make me happy this week because I feel like they're the future and that's that.
Coffee clink to that.
All right.
Coffee.
Yum.
Yum.
All right. Peace out, witches.
Oh yeah. Wait, find us on Twitter. You were premature on that. Find us on Twitter at DWBB Podcast. Email us your stories about, you know, good witches, bad bitches in your life, in your family, anything like that. We would love to talk about them on air. DWBB Podcast at gmail.com. We are so ready to just constantly be learning about awesome women.
I know.
In history.
This has been...
This is the best.
I learned so much.
I look forward to it every time.
Yes.
It's the best time.
Agreed.
Chilling in Brooklyn.
Chilling in Brooklyn.
Boom, boom, boom.
Boom, boom.
Thanks,
boom.
Witches.
Thank you.
We'll figure out some way to... No, we won't. We're probably never going to figure out how to sign off. But help me, weird. We're super weird people, so...